you might be down a little bit sooner than not. So thank you all for being here tonight. I guess we do not have a quorum again, sadly, so we cannot approve our December and January meetings. We may move those out via email or have to approve three meetings next meeting. And I don't believe that there are any public members here for comment, so moving right along. So department updates, and Chuck's going to do his update first.
You want to quit?
Man, you're right.
Hello, Chuck Carter. I am a program manager in the Department of Public Health, and I oversee several programs. I oversee on-site septic and drinking water. And to the two topics I was going to get to on today are related to that work and those resources. The first one has to do with, so back in 2015, there was a significant Supreme Court decision referred to as Hearst versus Whatcom County. And it was based on a suit against the county asserting that they were allowing for what are called permit exempt wells. So these are mostly wells for homes and residences that they weren't really allowed to do under the existing Department of Ecology rules. And so it sent a chill throughout most of the state because it was going to limit in many counties across the state their ability to allow people to build. And so there was from that very beginning of the Hearst, what's referred to shortly as the Hearst decision, was the legislature was going to take action to correct and try to mitigate where the law, and the other part of the decision was that the counties had a lot more authority in the Growth Management Act to regulate and make decisions about water use. And that was really a big concern because generally that's been Department of Ecology's purview. And so the fix was also to return that authority back to ecology. So one of the things I understand about the setting around that was that Clark County, as it turns out, there are a set of rules called Water Resource Inventory Area Rules that apply to many basins across the state. And even Whatcom County had these types of rules their rules were established in about 2000, 2001. Clark County's, the rules that govern the watersheds that go through our county were established in 2009. And by the time they got around to doing our rules, they had made reservations in there for permit exempt water use. In Whatcom County, they did not have those provisions. And so that's what caused this problem, is that the suit said that there are no rules that allow the county to allow this water use. So when Hearst came out, there was a lot of concern in Clark County about what's the impact on this on our development, our ability to allow people to get a permit exempt well use. Well, as it turns out, because we already had the water resource inventory area rules in place already that had those reservations in them, we were really impacted by Hearst. We were still governed and continue to be governed by these water resource inventory area rules, WIRA, is how we refer to them. And I'll talk a little bit about real broadly around the parameters around that. So those are the rules that existed that we have and will continue to work under. So back in January, though, the Senate did pass in gross substitute Senate Bill 6091 to as the quote unquote fix to the Hearst decision. They also put some parameters in there to address some other Supreme Court decisions around water use and water allocation in the state. But in essence, most of the Senate Bill 6091 doesn't, again, impact Clark County because we were never impacted in the first place. It's mostly addressing how to now allocate water and make decisions and put watershed plans in other areas of the state that do not have rules with the reservations that we already have under the rules that we're governed by in Clark County. So that, in short, is the answer, is that Hearst didn't affect us, the new bill doesn't really affect us, but it's a good opportunity to talk about how do we make decisions about allocating permit-exempt water use. So, and I kind of covered I had these first two items that I've talked to. So I did want to show you a couple of maps. The first map, I'll go all the way to the last map in this presentation. So hopefully you can see this fairly well. So this is a map of counties across the state. You'll miss the top. And it's color-coded, and you're not going to be able to see all the coding. But essentially, there's only a few areas that are colored that indicate whether there's been a watershed plan enacted or whether there are already these WIRA rules for governing permittings of water use and other water allocations. And basically what you can see is that the Lewis Basin and the Salmon Washougal Basin, which are number 27 and 28, that again is just a visual map acknowledging what I was just telling you, is that we are governed by these WIRA rules. There's nothing that we have to do related to HRSA to regulate differently how we allocate water in the county. So the two rules that do govern the county are WIRAs, and it's Washington Administrative Code 173, 527, and 173, WAC 173-528. And this is the Lewis River. And so all of these basins. So this is the Lewis Basin, which covers part of Clark County and then Cowlitz, and I think the west side dips into Skamania, or the east side. And so all of these basins have allocations assigned to them for permit-exempt water use. Now, the way that these rules work is for every sub-basin that has so much water assigned to it for permit-exempt well use, Ecology is going to keep through the book counting. So as we permit these wells in the county, they're going to count them up. So at some point in the future, we can't predict how far out, you will use up that water reservation. But we are going to know as we're getting closer to that, because the rules also require that Ecology tell us, hey, you used up 75% of your allocation, you've used up 50%, et cetera. So in essence, the rules have a process for allocating and counting that water. And again, this is all around protecting the surface waters, because groundwater and surface water are connected. So these reservations have been made, so as people build a home and come in to get a well, we're approving the wells under that framework. And then also just to add, even municipal water systems, because in Clark County, just like Clark Public Utilities, all of their drinking water, right, is all groundwater. So they even have reservations in these rules for municipal, just like City of Vancouver. So now you've got sort of the 10-minute, 5-minute, how do we allocate water in Clark County? Mm-hmm. So this is the Salmon Washougal Basin that has several sub-basins. So the one area in the county where and the term that is used is closed basin, is the Burnbridge Creek sub-basin. So this area of the county, which as you can see, the gray area here is, the gray areas are municipalities. And so this is City of Vancouver here, and I think Camas and Washougal are gray on this map. Hopefully you can see that. And these maps are in those WACs that I referred to earlier. But basically, Burnbridge Creek is closed to permit exempt well. So now when we get an application and most of this is served by City of Vancouver Water, but there are still corners of even here where there's not public water available. And so again, if someone comes into us with Burnbridge Creek and they're inside this basin, in general, the first response is, well, this is a closed basin, we can't allow permit exempt well. Now the rules also allow, though, for other measures that you can take to first demonstrate that if you put in a well, you're not going to impact surface waters. Other mitigations to maybe add water back in some other way or whatever. So it's not an absolute no. The other thing we've learned, last fall we got two applications in. One was close to public water supply, so they just went to public water. Another one wasn't. But in that case, it was a property that was near the river. And we basically took their site information, sent it to Ecology, and Ecology evaluated that and made a decision that, yes, this well can be used because it's not really within the basin that drains into Burnbridge Creek, so it would not be expected to affect surface water levels. So I wanted to provide a little bit of detail in those two cases just to give you some context around how the rules govern us and and how we use those rules to allow water use. And that, in a nutshell, is the rule. I'll go back to the top. But I think most of what I just explained to you is in here. Again, if you're more curious, these are the two WACs that govern how we allow water. So that's it. And before I move on, so that I was going to go on to a new subject, but are there any questions about this? All right, great. Thank you. So the other thing I just wanted an update on, and this will be shorter. So in recent history and in the past, there was a loan program available for folks that needed to do repairs, replacements on their septic systems. And it was through community development block grant funds from HUD and community services. The county community services managed that fund. But because they're federal funds, they have a lot of hoops to jump through to qualify to get the funds. And so even though we have folks that have gotten those funds to help do repairs and replacements of septic systems, it hasn't been a great volume because a lot of people just couldn't meet all the qualifications and requirements. Well, for about 6 years now, there's been a program that's been mostly focused around Puget Sound, and it's a large, it's called the Regional Loan Program, and it's a large fund that's funded out of Clean Water State Revolving Loan monies and a Clean Water Grant that the state manages, the Centennial. And basically, those funds are used to fund a pot of money that's managed by a third-party nonprofit bank called Craft 3. And they're able to use that, because they're clean water funds, to make loans with very agreeable terms and very agreeable loan rates for the same thing, septic system repairs and replacements. Well, a couple years ago, one of our staff learned about this at the on-site conference. And basically, starting in January, the county now, and it was solely, the RLP was counties around Puget Sound. Well, now we've been added, and Cowlitz has been added to that, to have access to those funds starting in January. So right now, Clark County citizens can now get access to what we're referring to it as the Craft 3, a regional loan program. And it, so we did a press release last week. I saw it actually made it into the paper today. We're going to be doing more, and we've got material on our website. Next week, we're doing a training with our professionals community who can attend. So we're going to start letting people know that if you have a replacement or repair, you need the system, there's another resource available to you. So we really hope, we think a lot of people aren't taking action or getting inspections done because they know they have a problem. So we're hoping that this opens the door to more people saying, okay, yeah, I now have a way to get a loan that I can pay back and under manageable terms for fixing my system. So that's really big news for us, because we're hoping that it'll generate. And we actually did just get someone signed up like 2 days ago. So already someone signed up for this.
Would people usually use just like a home equity line? Like, how do people pay for that normally? Like, what kind of a line?
Well, we don't normally know how people are paying in most cases. Now, if they're using the HUD program, we know that, because
right.
Generally, and in this program too, Craft 3 will also run the same way. Basically, the homeowner isn't getting a pot of money. Mm-hmm. They're getting the approval to have so much money committed to fixing their system. And the funds are really managed from Craft 3 and HUD to pay through the service providers, mm-hmm. and or pay to the county for the expenses required to do the fix. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
so generally, if other people are doing it privately funding, we wouldn't know.
Right, do you feel like?
Well, I think on a lot of them belong to credit unions or borrow on the house. The HUD program at the beginning kind of worked good,
yeah.
But then the limit of the value of the property was so low, mm-hmm. price of housing going up, and during the recession, so many people were upside down on their loan. The program became non-existent, in my opinion.
Yeah, it wasn't used very much.
And in Clark County, I know that our septic, always we get a reminder from Alan. I need to get my septic system looked at.
My name is on there, yes.
It depends on the type of septic that you have that needs to be reviewed, or are all septic systems annually need to be...
Yeah, so the rules around requirements for how the periodicity of your inspections. If you have a basic gravity system, goes into the tank, flows out of the tank into a gravity drain field, it's every 3 years, okay, and that's in state and local code. For our pressure in Clark County, for a pressure distribution, so now it's the effluent's being pumped out to the drain field, that's every 2 years, because now you have electronics involved, mm-hmm. pressure systems, they have to run really well. And then anything that's more complicated than that, it's every year.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've come to fact to talk about this before, but you know, we've been stepping up our, because there are still quite a few systems that haven't, that are out of compliance with that schedule. Mm-hmm. And we've been working mostly through a notification and prodding, because it wasn't being done for a while, a few years ago. We've made some progress in getting the amount of compliance better, but we still have several thousand systems out there that haven't been inspected yet. And so we're now working on a plan for how we can maybe step that up. But part of the, having this loan program will really hopefully allow more people access to funds.
Can I just, I may be inaccurate about this, but failing septic systems are a social determinant of health, because it could keep people from being, getting them repaired can keep people from becoming homeless.
Right.
Because the homes become uninhabitable.
Right.
If their septic systems can't be repaired. And we've had those discussions in the past, you know, what do? You got a family that's in a home where the septic system is failing, and the choices are very difficult. This helps.
Mm-hmm. Is there like an income limit for this program, or can anyone apply, or is it?
I think there are eligibility requirements. I'll scroll down a little bit here. So the eligibility requirements, there are some things about the system has to, it can be so old and it's failing, and or it's failing, or they've been contacted by us, but usually they've been contacted by us, we know there's a problem, and or they're under orders to fix their septic system. And so again, that's part of our overall strategy, is as we can increase the compliance and really get people to make a decision that they need to get their inspection done, and if they find problems, that they'll be able to address them. But that's the barrier. I mean, it's an economic barrier. Not so much the cost of an inspection. I mean, generally, an inspection for a standard system is about $120, we're told, or that's what the professionals charge. Again, it would go up for a more advanced system. And pumping, if you have to actually pump your tank out, that you can get into the $400 to $500 range, depending on the size of the tank. So those are barriers. But then I think, again, a lot of these folks that are still not doing it, it's probably a mix, but there's probably a good set of them that know they have a problem, and they know if they get it inspected and it's going to be reported, that we're going to know they have a problem then.
If you're looking at, say, replacing the system, usually a repair is kind of a misnomer. We're not repairing that system that failed. More times than not, they're going to a whole new system.
Yeah.
If they have an older tank, we've got to prove that it's not leaking by the time you go through that and everything. Certain tanks we know are leakers, so we're putting a new system in. You can have anywhere from 6,500 to 20,000,
yeah,
or even a little higher at times.
But a lot of the folks that, you know, don't get it done have difficulty qualifying for loans. This would help some of those folks. Is that
exactly
correct?
Yeah, that's it. And this is really hard to read. We have brochures, and they're on their website, and I have a link to their website. But if you're curious and you just search on Craft 3, you would come up with this. They've also been doing this program in Oregon for many years. But these are some of the terms and the interest rates for the loans, depending on that part of it is income based. So again, I think it offers a lot more, something that'll be a lot more available to folks out there that need to do something. And then
I imagine it'd be like the HUD program. I'll have to say, if they hire me, I've got to submit an estimate of what my cost. Mm-hmm. Cost to perk test and design it, the installer needs to provide an estimate. I don't know if they have how many bids they need or yet. Then when the job's done and approved by the health department, then that's probably when they pay the installer, and they may pay the designer before that. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. The check comes probably with Texas Craft 3, I imagine.
Yeah, so we're getting a little more training next week on the 21st in the morning. because CalEd's also now has availability. So, and then in the afternoon, there's a second training for the professional community, so they can also be ambassadors and help clients learn about this program and know how to access it.
I would assume that you're going to get information on who's how many of these loans go out, so that you can.
Yeah, we'll know. Yeah, that'll be a really good indicator. And again, like one of the things they since they've been doing this with the other counties, greater than 300 septic systems with a net, I guess a net value of money loaned of $7.3 million. So it's very effective where it's been applied in the Puget Sound area.
Puget Sound in the shellfish areas, that's where I think it got its start.
Yeah.
And on the shellfish areas, there's some really difficult repairs, or they had to build bulkheads and then do sand filters behind that. Just a lot of the sound, the houses started out small houses and then they did the big mansions on it, and they just had no areas. And those systems could be very expensive.
So thanks. I was done. Any more questions? We can go on to the next thing. We got a question.
So there's this backlog of potentially non-compliant, like thousands. Or
yeah, there's thousands of them.
So I know in Washougal, we have some big brothers that like to tell us what we need to do, like health and ecology. Are there consequences to the county for having that backlog? Under the state dynamic, there's a mass.
None that I'm aware of. I mean, the numbers that we have, we know about them because we track all those systems. So there's no, if there's one, no one's told me about it yet. They haven't come to us. And again, we want to develop an approach to get those folks up for whatever their reasons are to get those inspections done and then address any systems that need repairs, replacements, whatever. But we also want to be careful about it. I mean, our professional community's feedback to us too is be careful about how you do enforcement. That we have a really good O&M program here in the state relative to a lot of parts of the state. And I'll just say it's a huge political issue. There have been pushes to try to make it a requirement to have O&M and O&M contracts statewide through the legislature, and there's a lot of pushback to that. So we have a pretty good system, and we do get a lot of inspections done. We want to get to better compliance, but we want to go forward with that carefully so that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, kind of thing. We don't lose the effective program that we already have.
So I just went to the CRAP 3 site. So it's income-based, depending on your rate. So if you're below up to $35,000, your interest rate is 1.99%, and you can choose a deferred payment. You can choose interest-only payments or fully amortized payments. So you have a deferred payment, you have no monthly payment for 179 months. So there's more choices for folks who are lower income. And then the interest rate goes up as your income goes up, but they make it. And you can get up to, get all the money you need to do a complete replacement if you need it. But low interest rates, deferred payments,
Clark
stuff
County
like that.
Clark County really has a good maintenance program. A lot of the rural counties really don't have any. The state rules say you got to have a maintenance program.
Okay, that's right.
And it's been kind of interpreted. If you tell somebody they need to maintain the system, quote, that's a program. But Clark County got kind of ahead of the game and everything. Really has a pretty good program and pretty good training of the operation maintenance specialist. There's a training manual and everybody's pretty much on the same page. So a lot of the work, the state has, health department has so many other problems, and they know that Clark County's doing really good. They're pretty pleased, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, they haven't heard anything about the non-compliance rate. And I would say generally, we're probably, even with that, we're probably doing better than the vast majority of counties in the state.
Chuck,
You
may have said this, but this program is available too if their septic system cannot be repaired. This also allows dollars to hook up to the sewer system.
Yes, because that's not very cheap either.
Right.
Those expenses can get into the teen or low teens, thousands. It just depends on where you are and how far away the hookup is.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Do you have a YouTube video or something on septic tanks?
There is a video. Go to our website. We have a septic video, OM video on our website. Very good.
Lovely.
Yes, there are some appropriate photos.
What you can and cannot put into your photo. Joe, is you food bill.
Yeah, thank you. Joe Laxon, program manager, oversees the school health and safety, food safety, and water recreation, which are public pools and swim beach monitoring. I wanted to be able to come this tonight and just update on a couple of legislative bills that have gone through both houses and is waiting the signature by the governor. I don't see any reason why the governor's not going to sign it. Paul, if you disagree with me on anything I say or have something kick me. I probably should have sat right here. I probably should have sat over there. So the first bill is House Bill 2639. And this bill actually was unanimous in both houses. It currently, Washington state law requires mobile units to have a commissary kitchen. And what that means is it has a kind of a brick and mortar kitchen where the operator prepares most of the food. They do all the cooking, they do the cooling, and then on the mobile, they do kind of final prep, reheating, assembling, that type of thing. So Washington state law requires a commissary. This bill would actually allow for an exemption from that if the mobile unit could show that they have all the necessary equipment on board to do all of the food processes in a safe way.
And this is like a food cart?
Yeah, a mobile. Yeah, a little bit more like a mobile truck.
A truck.
Yeah, which is...
More and more common.
More and more common, yeah. It's obviously with Portland who... you know, they have quite a bit looser restrictions in Oregon and Portland. We're getting a lot more mobiles over here. It's a really great entryway into the food industry. The food industry is a tough industry. And so to do a full brick and mortar facility is really challenging. And so mobiles provide kind of an easy entry into the food industry. Someone who's got an idea can try something out with a little bit less money investment, see if it works. We've had a number of mobile units actually transition to brick and mortar as well. So and actually we've had a number of brick and mortars start mobile carts too, because it kind of meets a unique demand for food industry within the county. So it's definitely a growing industry within the county. We actually were really supportive of this. We were able to provide feedback to the legislature and comments to the legislator who was sponsoring this bill, and he was willing to take in all the considerations, which we thought was really great. There was some public health controls that we tried to instill in that bill. It's only two pages, so it's not a real complex bill. So. I think one big positive for this within the industry is commissary space is really tough to come by within our county. There's only a few public kitchens within the county, and so scheduling's really challenging. A lot of times you'll have multiple mobile unit owners in there in that kitchen at the same time, prepping food, trying to get out before there's a rush to get out and start serving their food. So this will hopefully alleviate some of that burden. It'll hopefully alleviate some of that burden. And honestly, our department's had concern about commissaries being a source of foodborne outbreaks, because you have multiple individuals coming into that kitchen doing different processes, cross-contamination, potentially ill worker that can contaminate multiple food trucks. So we feel like this is a good opportunity for mobile truck owners not only to have more flexibility within their business model, but also to hopefully protect public health and also alleviate some of that demand on commissary kitchens within the county. So we are, one additional step with this is because of this effort, as well as wanting to standardize how different counties are handling mobiles around the state. Every county does it a little different. The Department of Health has convened a technical advisory committee for the state. And on that committee, there are essentially four counties represented that are representing different size counties on size counties on different sides of the Cascades. And then there are mobile food industry representatives, there are nonprofits, there's a whole myriad, there's 15 members on this committee. That committee is actually already drafted and will be hopefully by April producing a guidance document for all the counties to use as a template for doing plan review for mobiles to standardize it and also to incorporate this law, the change in this law. What does it mean when a mobile has to have all of the necessary equipment for hand washing on the mobile? What does that mean? And so we'll hopefully have some standardized implementation of this rule, which I think is a really positive thing. We're fortunate, Adam Lim, who's our lead environmental specialist, and myself have been chosen to represent large counties on the west side of the Cascades on that technical advisory committee. So we're excited to have direct input into the rules and the guidance document creation. So we're excited to kind of not only represent, you know, King County and the larger counties, but also to really represent Clark County, the Clark County food industry and our constituents. So that is the one bill that I wanted to cover. Is there anything that you want to?
I'm all for it.
I didn't get kicked, so that's good. No?
So just to understand, yeah. So they can make their food in their own kitchen and then bring it on, or no, they have to do everything in the mobile unit?
They have to do everything in the mobile unit.
So they buy their food, or does a food truck, or like the produce people come to the mobile unit and then they buy, like when you see the,
yeah,
whatever?
It'd be basically just like a regular restaurant.
Okay.
So you have to have the storage. Mm-hmm. You have to have the right refrigeration, the right cooking, everything like that. You can't have the produce sit out anywhere, you know, where it's not safe.
So if
that's the whole key behind what I feel is good, it's because safety, food safety is the whole.
But what if those people don't have that option for their mobile unit? Can they still use the commissary units, or how?
They can. Yeah, it's essentially an exemption that we would grant
to the mobile owner
if they can demonstrate they have everything they need to do it in a safe way. So it's not essentially a right that they can just say, I don't want a commissary. They have to demonstrate that within our application process, and then we would be able to offer that exemption from WAC, but a specific requirement.
Okay.
So there is some administrative work to do on our ends as far as how we're going to actually process that type of thing, but I think in the long run it would be a little positive.
So you said there's public kitchens, so who owns or operates those? I've never heard of them.
Yeah, there's not a lot, unfortunately. Right? We've only got a few in the county, so it's a private owner that buys a facility, installs a commercial kitchen. And then they will rent that out to mobile units. We also have temporary vendors, so people at the farmers markets, at a lot of the fairs, they'll use those commissaries to do their food prep. We've got a couple more hopefully being built, which would be really helpful. Actually, there hopefully there's going to be one downtown, which would be really helpful for our downtown vendors. We're always trying to encourage that. Technically, actually, any restaurant can be a public kitchen. So if it's a permitted kitchen, it can be used by other vendors. The challenge with that is obviously it's an active restaurant. So you're talking in the middle of the night, prepping or prepping at very selective, limited hours. So it's a challenge. So most of the time, people use these specific public kitchens to do that prep because there's typically more flexibility. Less and less, but this might hopefully allow for some more flexibility. So, yeah, questions about that bill? It's always fun talking regulations. So the second one, which I believe I was here 2 months ago discussing service animals. So This is a hot topic. So House Bill 2822, almost unanimous passage in both houses. This really cleaned up a lot of the state regulations around service animals. What is a service animal? Kind of some of the highlights of it, it clearly identified service animals within Washington law as a canine or a miniature horse. So, yeah.
That makes sense.
I'm really wanting to see one. And then it Kind of increased a little bit of the requirements on food service managers to ask the two questions, but it also went an extra step to say if someone is found to be essentially faking or misrepresenting their animal, an enforcement officer, so not sure what that means.
With your pig and they go, hey, that's a pig, and you go, no, it's a horse.
Yes.
Going to jail.
You're going to jail. Well, it clearly outlines a $500 civil fraction for that, for misrepresenting. So the law kind of, it outlines that an enforcement officer may respond, ask those two questions, and if it's, there's a number of language, there's specific terms obviously within the law, but willfully or, you know, not completely mistakenly misrepresenting their animal as a service animal, that they can be issued a civil infraction for that. So, there's obviously a lot of policy and resource implications with that. I think one thing which I may have mentioned in the last presentation about this was that, these requirements are challenging for food service operators to navigate. It's a legal hot potato. I think in our discussions with our technical advisory committee, with the public, and people who misrepresent their animals believe it's a harmless issue. They think it's not a big deal. I think this law, it helps a little bit that we can say there is a penalty, because before we couldn't say that. And LA County, they did a study, they were struggling with this. They had signs up at restaurants and grocery stores that basically said, you shall not do this. Then they took new signs and put on that there's a civil infraction of this amount, and they saw complaints start to go down. So I think part of it is it provides a little bit of, enforcement power to our education message. Before it was just education, that you shouldn't do this, it's really challenging. It really is not a harmless thing to do to misrepresent your animal. It is detrimental not only to the individuals that rely on these animals for true services, but it puts food restaurant owners and other public space owners and operators in real difficult situations. So I think in that way, I think it'll help to some extent. It'll help with our messaging. I think we'll just kind of have to see. We are working with our technical advisory committee to get some education materials produced. I think I might have mentioned that at the last meeting. So we'll be doing that again at our next meeting, just talking about how does this infuse our partnership and our education and trying to get the word out there. We'll hopefully have some media coverage on it. We had some media coverage on this issue a number of months ago, and I think it really helped a little bit to diffuse the issue a little bit. So we'll hopefully do that again with this. So
I think more of the issues as they are happening now are more in the markets than they are in the restaurants. I find a few. But in the markets, it seems like it's a never-ending thing. Hey, the markets are easy to look. How big it is, a lot of room down the aisle. I can carry this dog in my purse, and
if you have a miniature horse, they can graze in the produce section.
That's right. Yeah.
Hey, Joe, is this a bill been signed?
Not by the governor. No, not yet. But it's pending, so we'll see.
I had a question about animals, like say a bar or a tavern, they have outdoor seating.
Yeah.
And the dogs are allowed in that area. What's the status on that?
So currently Washington state law prohibits any animal being on the premises that's not a service animal. So that includes patios, includes sidewalks, technically. For our office to respond to that in a timely manner to actually observe that going on, it's really difficult. So we know that's happening. There is, the food code's gonna be revised starting this spring. That's part of that technical advisory committee that was created that will be doing that. There is a pretty strong, I think, support already to allow animals on patios and that type of thing, outdoor venues. So I think there will be some changes with that.
So it wouldn't require a statute, it would just require a WAC change, basically,
exactly.
Which is what food code is.
Exactly, yep.
And that's true for places that do not serve food as well as serving food, like bars and restaurants.
Yes, exactly.
That what's in place, and what kind of an enforcement, like what kind of a, what would the restaurateurs like have to pay? Would they, what kind of fee is it for having? Because I think that more people that have animals, like they see somebody with their dog, they're like, oh, well, this place is dog friendly, and they have no idea. And of course, the people that own them are kind of known for having this dog friendly environment, but it's really not dog friendly. They're just breaking the law, but no one really wants to say anything.
Yeah, as far as the food code,
so what kind of is it a fee or is it a
we have it's a violation. Uh-huh. It's a low risk violation. Because we have not had any outbreaks related to animals, and so it's not a high risk, which is a red violation. It's a blue, low risk. So we don't do a lot. We don't have the capability to do a lot around it. We do have some policies where if we see repeat blue violations, we can move into a higher level. But honestly, with the pets, it's fairly low risk. We don't typically will go into an enforcement mode per se, but if we're there, if we observe it, we can take a violation.
Well, I think all the people that go, they don't mean any harm. No. They actually think it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everybody else has done it, and of course it's okay. Yeah. It's a bar, and they're not there.
Unless somebody brings your pet turkey in there, or their
turtles,
or their
turtles.
Yeah.
That'd be a good idea.
That
a patio, like hypothetically, if I was at a brewery on Mill Plain,
yes,
an outdoor patio that they allow pets on. Is that illegal or legal?
Because the brewery, I think.
Well, the brewery, you on law.
Exactly. You are the enforcement guy, and you give them a fine.
They advertise your pet friendly.
You can say
people sit on the picnic tables outside, and everybody's got their pets.
Yes.
And hypothetically, I know one lady that will do that, and she'll bring our dog, hypothetically. And has a dog chair, and she puts the dog on the bench, and we have lunch, not me, because I'm not there. And the dog's sitting there. I'm just curious, is that
break the law, Bob.
So, yeah, Bob. As long as the dog can have a beer.
So there are some, not to speak of that hypothetical brewery, there are some breweries and or bars that do not have a food permit. They are solely regulated by the liquor control. Yeah. So
they still have to serve food.
They still have to serve. They can have some minimal food that are exempt and therefore would need a food permit. Okay. Most bars, most breweries will have a food permit.
What if they have glasses? What if they use glasses?
If they have glasses, yes, then they have.
Then they'd have to. So they're doing. So the ones that are exempt are using paper or plastic.
Okay. Yeah. Really? Okay. So hypothetically, if I went to a brew pub that only serves beer, but they have a food cart out on their patio that they don't serve food, but the food cart does, where are they?
That hypothetically, that bar does have a food
service. I need to know these things.
That one. Well, we have a couple of those. Most all of those do have a food service permit because of the ware washing.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
And some of them will still offer some small appetizers that require a food permit.
When you get your, I don't feel like these owners have any idea that it's a small print in there somewhere that they just haven't really.
One place in the summertime, people were walking their dogs and they stopped by to have a beer or a sandwich and. You see the dog walking through the seating area out to the patio. I think now they can bring the dog to the patio directly, not through the area. But it's more of a neighborhood social thing.
Yeah, people like it. Hopefully, we'll get past it. Will be quite as
And I think that's where we, as a program, we don't want to put a lot of emphasis on that. We see the rule change coming. It's not a huge public health threat. Right. As you can probably imagine, we have a lot bigger health risks that we need to deal with restaurants.
And it's a social thing.
Occasional animal.
Have you looked at what I think California dealt with this issue years ago, and they do allow it to.
Multnomah County allows dogs on the patio.
Yeah, so it's coming. And so I think we want to advise anyone approaching dog owners or pet owners at those facilities.
Miniature horses. Miniature horses are potentially an 0157.
Well, that's true.
Pot-bellied pigs. That's a good one.
Yeah.
As long as they're not on planes, I'm good. I mean, you know, pigs and turkeys.
Snakes.
Yeah.
Salmonella. Yeah.
So if we do see other animals other than canines and a miniature horse, then we know we want to have those excluded, but we don't want to throw the dog hair around.
I don't know if you have some of that horses. I wouldn't be able to tell a miniature horse from a small horse.
Whatever it is, we don't want to
that's
be too...
That's a pony. That's
not a miniature horse. Whatever our approach, we don't want to be too dogmatic about that.
Here it comes. Oh, man. So we have time for puns.
All right.
So moving on.
Sorry, Dr.
Thank you, Joe.
I couldn't resist.
Dr. Milnick, you're on.
Okay, so...
Joe.
What?
Oh, Joe and Chuck are going to be leaving us now, so thank you very much for your
thank
you. Thank you.
Yeah, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. And Alan's got our number.
And I can't promise anything, but if you want a personal reminder from Alan, when you get your system inspected, let us know. We'll set it up.
I'm messing with your phone.
So, House Bill 1047 passed both houses. That is the medication take-back program. So, remember, we had talked about working with our board to pass an ordinance here, no longer necessary. So, the state law will preempt local, and the state law is good. So, basically, the pharmaceutical companies will be paying and operating a drug medication take back. It'll, like, it's working in several counties already, which did have ordinances. I imagine that take back locations will be in pharmacies and hospitals. That'd be in an area where there's a line of sight where somebody's working. So typically it'll end up being pharmacies and hospitals. And what's really good about that is that they're extended hours. They're all over the county. It's really convenient for people to take their drugs, clean out their medicine cabinets, and take their unused medications to these drop-off sites. No questions asked. Don't have to bring it to the police department or the sheriff's office where you have to put stuff into evidence. It's just a simple take-back system, and nobody asks any questions. And you do over-the-counter meds as well. But so we'll see that. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to start here. I'd have to take, but it will be sometime soon. So the governor, there's a signing ceremony this week, so the governor will be signing it. Opioids. So there was a governor, so this is interesting, because remember Joe was talking about unanimous votes. Well, the opioid bill, which was sponsored by the governor, which is it was a good bill, actually passed on the House side 98-0, and then failed to make it out of committee in the Senate, never got to the Senate floor. So these things happen during short sessions. People in a hurry to get done, and the bills can die even if they're popular. Obviously, this one had bipartisan support. It would have increased access to treatment services, coordinated services between treatment and healthcare systems, community partnerships. There was prevention in it as well around opioids. So I'm sure it'll come back next session. But anyway, that was a bit of a disappointment. That was House Bill 2489. So that's my legislative update on those bills. And I think I was pretty quick.
Okay. You're still on.
Okay. Crisis standards of care. I'll be really brief about this as well. So many of you may know, and I think we may have presented it to you, that in Clark County, like over the last few years, we've actually gone through a process around with our ethics committee around developing an allocation plan for ventilators if the demand, if we had a respiratory disease pandemic and the demand for ventilators exceeded supply. And actually, we're working with both hospitals to basically develop plans to implement that ventilator allocation plan. In the meantime, the state, and I'm on the statewide committee on this, decided that they really needed to look at altered standards of care, altered crisis standards of care, similar process. It's basically if there's a huge either a biologic event or some sort of other event where more people need crisis care, like ICU care, than is available, how will we determine who's going to get it and who's not going to get it? I feel we had a pretty rigorous process with our ethics committee. They have another process that's going to be kind of interesting. I'm looking forward to this, see how it turns out. But they've contracted with an organization called Resolve. And Resolve does a process called QSOAR, where they have these community forums and people vote on different, there's different questions and people vote on it. And I'm not sure exactly how the software works, but what they're doing is they're going around the state and they're having these 3 or 4 hour community forums where it's actually going to be advertised to the entire community, where people come and they're basically going to be deliberating about altered standards of care in a crisis. And they're doing this in a number of communities across the state, and we were selected as one of them. I've actually already sent out the invitation to our ethics committee. I think it's going to be interesting here to see what this process comes up with, how it differs with what we came up with. But anyway, we're trying to get as many people as possible. It's going to be April 11th, I believe, and we gave you a handout in your packet. It's from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. I believe we'll be providing, I think there are going to be food provided as well, I'm pretty sure. Participation is voluntary. And if you know of anybody who might be interested, certainly FAC members are encouraged to attend. I think it'll be an interesting learning experience.
It'll be here at this
place. It'll be here in this room, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, 210, yeah, right in here.
Ooh, you get $70 if you show up.
Exactly.
First 25, get here early.
Wow.
Each meeting, are there more than there's?
They're all across the state. So I just sent you the one for Clark County, but they're having these meetings across the state. So DOH, State Health Department, is kind of leading the way on this one.
Has this been done in other states?
I believe it's been done in. I'm not sure about that. I think Resolve has done that in other states, and I don't know what the outcome was. Yeah, our approach was really different. What we did was we got our content experts together, critical care folks. Then they use what was in the literature around allocation, and then we brought it to the ethics committee. Then we had a framework. If you're familiar with how our ethics committee works, and you're on it, I believe we have a framework that we go through in terms of how we deliberate issues. And then we brought it to the faith community reps, and then we brought it, actually, we tried to reach out to folks who are on home ventilators. Like we reached out to the ALS Association. We weren't able to get any of those folks, but we did get representatives of providers of home ventilators. Anyway, we came up with the final recommendation. I'd be happy, I think we presented it here already. So it'll be interesting to compare this process with what we did so early. Nobody else has done what we did, as far as I know, anywhere, either in the state or elsewhere. So I encourage people to attend. That was hopefully brief. Okay. I think that's... Oh, I have one more. Oh, you're... Jeff is up. Any questions on that? Great.
So we are in the process of working on our 2019 and 20 biennial operating budget. Looking right now, it's going to be about a $2.5 million deficit. This actually includes a brand new HIV prevention grant, which is $150,000 per year for 5 years. It includes the assumption that the Foundation for Public Health Services funding will continue beyond the current allocation, which ends in June of 19. And also includes the return of one of our environmental public health grants that was held up in the state capital budget, SNAFU. We are hoping we should be able to generate around $1.2 million, hopefully, in mental health sales tax revenue to fund our nurse funding partnership program. That would bring the deficit down to about $1.3 million. environmental public health fee revenues, we would bring those forward to be adjusted. We're not to the point where we know how much that would generate. In previous budgets, that generates around $400,000 to $500,000 a biennium. So we still have a deficit to address. The county is doing a new priority-based budgeting process. So we're hoping that shakes out in our favor, where they would actually place public health as a priority department, hopefully give us additional funds. Part of that priority-based budgeting is they're doing what's called program budgeting, which, lucky for us, we've done it for 20 years. So we're way ahead of the game as far as, you know, as that goes. We'll know a lot more in the next couple of months. The budgets are actually due June 8th. So it's a much quicker process than in prior budgets. So we'll have a lot more info in the next couple of FAC meetings. We'll probably need support from FAC around fee adjustments for environmental health and potentially for a request for additional county funds. So any questions on the budget?
So you've been doing this for years. Does this number right now, is this concerning you?
I would say yes, not as much as prior budgets. I think it concerns me this time because there's not, it doesn't appear that there's that safety net. The county also is having a very difficult budget right now, very difficult. The annexation by the city of the area near Costco, the city has also canceled its contract around records management with the county, the Clark County Sheriff's Office. The need for a new jail, there's a lot of the settlements, the legal
$6 million, that's a one-time deal, but that was $6 million.
That came directly out of the county general fund, so it's a very, very difficult budget process. It's too early, really, to know how worried I should be or we should be. I am worried right now that the deficit is as large as it is. I don't see environmental fee revenue adjustments covering what's left after the Menlo sales tax comes through. If you know, that should come through. Alan's on the Menlo sales tax task force and can probably provide more info if there's questions about that.
So it sounds like you might be looking at $750,000 or $500,000, $750,000. What percent of the discretionary budget is that? Because I know some of you got a lot of buckets, right?
We get about $4 million of biennium from the county in discretionary support, and about $3.5 million from the state discretionary support as well. Our total budget is around $21 million. So, $750,000. That's like 3%. So
it's 10% discretionary.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the, you know, as Jeff was already mentioning, I was out of the room, but a lot of the programs that are fee supported, the fees don't come close to paying the full cost of those programs.
Yeah.
But it's hard to raise fees. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah. The county commissioners in 2011 changed our fee model from a 100% cost recovery to where the county general fund would fund what's called greater good, so non-fee related services. The problem is our general fund support is flat. It's not indexed at all. So as those costs and those greater good services continue to increase, that's more of a gap. those greater good services are no longer funded sufficiently. It's been a sustainable public health budget. I've been here since 1998. This has been the situation every budget, almost every budget.
To give you an example of a greater good program, somebody calls one of the counselors and is complaining about rodents, and there's an overflowing dumpster and there's rodents, in there, and we go out and investigate and all that. There's no fees, don't, our solid waste fees don't cover that. So we do it because it's common, it's good for the public as a whole. If there's a foodborne outbreak, even if it's associated with a restaurant, restaurant fees don't cover that.
Raise the fees?
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, you may remember a few years
ago. I didn't say that.
A few years ago.
Don't put that in the minutes.
A few years ago, we had 120 cases of, we had 120 cases of salmonella associated with On the Border restaurant, which no longer exists, by the way. But think of the amount of work that it came into investigating 120 cases of salmonella. It was, yeah. Nothing pays for that other than county general fund. Yeah.
Fund balance.
Yeah.
Chipotle, On the Border, billion.
That's the greater good. Yeah.
Well, that's what people think that what the public health department does. Mm-hmm. So.
That's definitely a core public health service.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So, on that happy note, you guys have in your, you members of FAC, not you guys, I'm trying to be more professional, I'm going to come out very well with it. In your packet, you have a Community Health Award nomination. So, as you all know, you know, public health is not something that just our department does. We do that. We really work on public health across the community with community partners, community-based organizations, and other stakeholders and partners of the community. So it's us together that can actually do this work. And so every year we like to recognize a organization and an individual with the Public Health Community Award, and just to recognize the value of their work. And what we like to do is really have special consideration for individuals and organizations that forge partnerships and strive for community-wide outcomes. And so that's what we're really looking for, is someone, an organization, or a person that does that and is very collaborative. So we're going to be presenting the awards again this year at the Board of Health on April 25th. You all will be getting an invitation, and you're all welcome to attend. But you also, if you have someone that you would like to nominate or partners that you would like to send this to, please do. Nominations are coming in right now. I believe we have 3 so far. Mm-hmm. And we need the submissions in by 5 p.m. on April 4th. Oh. So if you can forward, and we'll have your a link in the notes as well, as well as this. Okay.
So is there a link somewhere that you can find out who got them in prior years?
Yeah,
it's on the internet. Like when you go to the link that's listed on the form at the very bottom, it'll show all the previous
awards.
Okay,
we'll include that in the notes. So you're all invited when we get those awards out. There's going to be a short presentation, and then usually the counselors are there and allows people to make a few comments. And they also have honorary mentions. So everyone that's nominated gets a certificate, and the folks that actually win the award get also like a plaque. So, all right, thank you. All right, Dr. Milnick, can you update?
Yeah, we're going to show you the beautiful graphic here. So if you scroll down a little bit, keep going. There you go. So the way we're still in the flu season. So the definition of the flu season is we don't count the number of cases of flu because the flu is not a notifiable condition. What we look at is a percentage of tests that doctors do that turn out positive. So if more than 10% of tests are positive, we're in the flu season. So that dotted line there is 10%, and the red line, which kind of ends with a little square in it there, the heavy red line, is the current flu season. The other lines are the previous flu season, so I hope you see that pretty well. The weeks, where it has CDC week, that's week of the year. So there's obviously 52 weeks in the year. So you could see that our flu season, if you see that heavy red bar this year, we actually got into it around week 48, like early December was the beginning of what we would call the flu season here. And it peaked around early January and has been coming down since then. We're now, and then you see there's a little uptick. So we're likely to continue to be in the flu season for another, could be a month or two. So not too late to get your flu shot. It takes about 2 weeks to build immunity. It's been a fairly, as flu seasons go nationally as well as here, it's been more on the severe side. So far, we've had, last year, we had about 20 outbreaks in long-term care facilities. This year, so far, we've had 13, so we're tracking it close. Last year, we had 26 deaths. As of a couple of weeks ago, I didn't bring in the latest number of deaths. We had about 11. They were all in either, most of them were in older folks. There was one child. All had, virtually all of them had other chronic conditions that made them more susceptible to influenza. So another reason to get immunized is not only to protect yourself, but to protect folks around you. We don't know exactly how effective the vaccine was this year. We won't know until towards the end of the flu season. We can look at all the data. But even if it's, you know, it's been advertised as somewhere being around in the 30s or so percentage, but I think a 30% decrease in either incidence or complications is a pretty, is better than zero. Mm-hmm. So I'd still use a seatbelt that have only worked 30% of the time. So better than 0% of the time. So that's where we're at. I don't know if there's any questions.
We're seeing about 4 to 10 patients a day on the inpatient side of Southwest.
Wow. And at the peak, how many were you seeing?
They peaked about 15 a day.
So we're still, that mirrors the graph pretty well. If you scroll down, not too fast. That's U.S., Washington, Oregon, and Clark County. So you see we're mirroring the other ones. Keep going down. Next one is long-term care facilities. And we're up to week 10. So we're, and you can see how those outbreaks kind of correspond with the number of positive tests. All these things go together. So we haven't had all the long-term care facilities, there's no current outbreak now, okay? And I think, and then the strain, the predominant strain this year has been H3N2, which tends to be more severe. I won't go into it more than that. And I don't know if I have anything else to.
I don't know if you talked about it, Alan, but there's a shortage of flu testing kits.
Yes, and that's kind of interesting because given the shortage, the denominator of people being tested may be smaller, so we may get an artificial bump in the percentage of tests. If providers are limiting their testing to people who are much more likely to have influenza or have complications, we may see that 10% figure exceeded, whereas it wouldn't have been otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah, and I've asked my docs to only test the one where we really need to know for sure.
Yeah, which makes sense. Okay. Oh, and then we look at it, we do something called syndromic surveillance where we look at influenza-like illness as well. And anyway, they all kind of, there are several different ways of looking at this. Anyway, that's my report on it. I don't want to go on too long.
I listen to NPR and my radio when I'm driving.
You and me both, yeah.
And OPB and NPR.
91.5, yes.
That's it. So and they have a British broadcasting hour every once in a while, you know, and so I was listening to about a story of the influenza pandemic of 1918, if anybody knows about that. It was a major epidemic that thousands and thousands of people died.
Millions.
In the United States, and millions around the world. And this was something that affected, you mentioned the children and the old people, this affected young people. And it moved so fast that people would be perfectly well in the morning and they would be dead at night. I mean, it was just like that. And of course, when I hear something like this, I get it, go to Amazon and look for books, and so I set off for a book on it, and I'm reading that now.
What's the name of the book?
It's just called Influenza Pandemic.
And one of the reasons why young adults might have been affected by that is that their, you know, your vigorous immune system can actually cause some damage,
yes,
as well.
Exactly. But they hadn't experienced anything like that, and it was right at the end of the war, and the soldiers were coming home. It started in Kansas, in the barracks. there, and you know, hundreds of people all of a sudden came down with this and it started spreading again like wildfire, and it, you know, and they didn't know how to treat it. I mean, it was just, that was the thing. So, you know, it was just like, it moved so fast. And so, as I say, I'm reading, I'll bring the book in the next, our next meeting. And so if anybody wants to read it, it's kind of, it's very interesting. So we are majorly blessed with where we are today because of the scientists and people who have come with the vaccines and everything like that to do this. It's just absolutely amazing. Yeah, so anyway.
Well, we did have an executive committee, and we talked a little bit about some changes. We kind of looked over our bylaws and updated some things. And one thing that we talked about before was the quote, members who miss three consecutive meetings, we would propose to change to members who have three unexcused absences per calendar year. And this, we don't need to vote on this, but we do need to provide the committee or provide the council a 21-day notice per our bylaws of this change so that people are aware. We've talked about it before. We just haven't changed it on our bylaws. So.
And we'll have to vote on it. We will vote on the April meeting, but we have to give you all 21 days notice prior to the vote. So we'll vote on this next meeting.
Yeah. So if there's any discussion, we've kind of talked about that before. In hopes to not have meetings where we don't have a forum. Yeah. And this is unexcused absences, so you know, if something were to happen, obviously it's kind of just one of those things. If you've got a chronic person that maybe has not enough time for this council, then you know, maybe we can find somebody that would better fit the position. But trying to be able to make our meetings productive and moving forward, we don't have three meeting minutes to approve every so there's our notice, 21-day notice started, and then we can have a discussion on I don't think we're gonna be able to take a vote on the printed copies needed rather than 25 copies. We probably don't need that many trees killed for our meetings. I don't know. Generally, do you feel like you get a huge packet of meeting minutes that we don't need to?
Depends on everybody else's feedback. Do you find it helpful, or do you think it'd be okay if we just had a handful, and if you needed to look at them, then you could, or what's most helpful for everyone?
As long as you send them out electronically, mm-hmm. we can.
And that's okay. Yeah. So maybe I'll just bring a few here for copies. Really good. Okay.
So what's your requirement for a quorum?
14 of the 20 members. It's 2/3. So you have 20 members and 14 people.
I was going to say, can you change the bylaws on the quorum to a simple majority? I mean, that's a tough standard to meet.
Yeah.
And you could still get good attendance because you still have the three meetings missed. Is that what you're suggesting? So it'd be easier to get a quorum, yet the other feature would help boost attendance anyway.
I don't think we have a copy of the bylaws. We have just one section of the bylaws, but I think we've had a copy of the bylaws.
I can call them up.
It's 2/3 right now, I believe.
Yeah,
it's
the bylaws states 2/3 at the moment, so yeah.
So
If you'd like to make that change, we could set that out in advance also.
We don't have a quorum here, but we can certainly discuss it.
Do we have the majority? If you all
feel good about that, then we'll send that out via email. We can vote on it via email, but what do you guys think?
Well, if we're going to vote on this, we could potentially vote on both.
Correct.
Bylaw changes.
Mm-hmm. I like David's idea.
Okay.
What is the health team think about that idea?
Well, I wouldn't like it except for the fact that getting rid of the three unexcused absences will take care of the attendance problem. And then if for some reason people, you know, at least you guys can still vote. Mm-hmm. I think it's in our interest to get as many perspectives here as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't want you guys to be paralyzed either because you can't. I mean, this is just me. Roxanne, I don't know how you feel.
No, I totally agree with that. I think the voices at the table, I mean, there's a large representation, and when we don't have that full representation, and that's consistently that we don't have that full representation, that can be a little bit of a problem going forward, especially as we plan our strategic approach to advising the board. So having as many members here is great. But
to your point, it's very difficult to get to new business with the rules that we have in place right now. So
I think if we do both changes, we get the best of all possible worlds and make it easy. We don't paralyze you guys because you can actually vote, but the three absences a year will actually get the attendance up.
Well, so we probably would need to, we would vote on this bylaw change, and then we would need to propose written proposal for the majority of the vote as another written proposal, 21 days. So
the state only requires a 60% vote to pass budgets in the House and Senate. Maybe not going to the majority, but a 60% would require only 12 attendees versus 14.
Oh, you're saying 60% instead of 2/3.
50% is just so minimal. It's hard to say that there's a lot of participation if your bar is that low.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what did you say was 60%?
The state budget process.
State budget process. So we can call mine that.
Sweet. Yeah, okay.
So we've got 11.
Okay, so yeah, at least a simple majority, you're always going to have 11.
Mm-hmm. That's close to
and we don't even have a simple majority tonight.
Don't we have 11? We've got 11, right?
Yeah.
Do you have 12?
I don't know.
1, 2.
It's the 11 or 20, that bar is so low. And
11. I'm ex officio, but that doesn't count, does it?
So if we were majority plus one, 11, we could do business this evening. If that's what we were.
What do you think of that, Jeff? Majority plus one. Well, they asked us for our opinion, so.
I think that bar is too low, in my opinion.
I don't think we're going to have that bar with the three.
Well, there's not a standard for excused absences. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we have some that. A simple majority. Is there anybody that, other than Jeff?
I'm not a voting member.
Yeah.
I think we'd be happy to. I was trying to be somewhat deferential to the team because I certainly value your opinion on that. You know, in my city administrator role, and those of us that work with governing, elected governing bodies,
yeah.
You know, it's majority plus one, and we're counting heads all the time for many different reasons, like. Don't sit together at that table, please, because it's an open, you know, we don't have those dynamics here. I don't want us to compromise the value of this group and the purpose that the Board of Health has set out for this group.
Right.
Because of some expediency and nuisance factor around minutes approval.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, how frustrating it is for the team and the leadership of our committee to say three times in a row that we don't have a quorum and we can't. Mm-hmm. It's just discouraging.
Yeah.
So there's a sweet spot. There's a sweet spot so we don't detract from value. And I'm open to be very deferential to you on that. And whatever you would bring back makes sense to me.
And on my board, it's a simple majority for most things, but like the minutes and month-to-month or day-to-day issues. And it's something that's more substantial that we have to have a super majority. Which is back to your two.
That might be the way to go.
Okay.
So what kind of things would be, so minutes would be 50%. Minutes would be majority plus one, is that what you're thinking? And what would be the kind of vote these guys would be doing that would require a super majority?
We send an advisory letter or something out where we're making a proposal, a recommendation as a board, like, you know, how we've authored letters before and stuff. That should probably be more than just the simple majority, don't you think?
Well, okay, so a policy letter might be a supermajority. What about a letter, let's say one of our partners is writing a grant or something and they want a letter of support from FAC for a grant application. I'm not trying to be too...
If you can vote by email, I think minutes would be one of the only things you'd want to do, majority plus one.
We don't do that many votes. I mean, I don't feel like we vote very often, so I feel like it, you know.
Sometimes can we just have the minutes be majority plus one and everything else be supermajority? Mm-hmm.
And what's a quorum then? I mean...
60%.
That's what they're defining.
Yeah, 60% sounds good for a quorum.
Mm-hmm. Well, you define the quorum as majority plus one, and then you specify that for certain... actions,
right.
You need to have mm-hmm. a certain vote. Kind of sounds like that's what the Crest is.
Yeah, and so doing. For my in the quorum, I need to have the 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. where the supermajority, like if I'm going to add a service or if I'm committing this to a long-term thing, then I need to have a supermajority. Mm-hmm. So.
But I do think the example that you gave about just a request for a letter of endorsement for a grant, something like that, those things usually have a really tight turnaround time. So if we, and so we could end up not being able to support something that we think would be good because of the timing and then the hurdle of having.
Well, I think a letter of support's one thing. If you're, if that grant comes with a commitment though that you're having to put funds for, then that's probably one where you want to make sure.
Yeah, that's a different thing.
And I don't see you guys having fun. So maybe this for minutes and for like things like support letters. I'm not sure how we'll word this in the bylaws. We'll come up with some wording, majority plus one. For policy recommendations, if you're making a recommendation to the, which is part of your main function, if you're making a recommendation to the Board of Health, that requires a supermajority.
And what is a supermajority? Is that 60%?
60%.
That's
would that be okay? So for policy recommendations, supermajority, for everything else, because you're not doing making budget recommendations. I mean, well, if you did, it would be a recommendation of the board. That would be a supermajority. So
policy recommendation, we can go on for hours, but policy recommendation or amending the fact charter, things like that.
Right.
I mean, there's obviously examples that would go beyond that.
And we said 60% is how many people?
12.
65. Actually,
isn't majority like one?
Typically, 60% of your total.
So it's to be 12.
So what is majority plus one?
11.
Why don't we just make it supermajority if possible? I mean, come on. It seems ridiculous. One person. Let's just make it supermajority.
That's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting supermajority for policy.
I think we just do supermajority for everything.
Including from 14 to 12.
Yeah. Oh, 14.
No, 12 is correct, because right, right now we're at two-thirds.
Two-thirds is 14.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're dropping it from 14 to 12. Yes. Yeah, I think that would be, I think we should make it simple.
I think that makes a whole lot of sense. Simple,
and we're dropping it a little bit, and then, you know, and then we've got some of the similarities.
Can you, that's what I would say. Can you live with that?
Well, I
you made the brilliant suggestion.
We can't take any action tonight.
We can't take any action
tonight. Oh, I know, but if this was 3 months from now and this was the group that was present, we wouldn't be approving minutes tonight. We have 11, not 12.
But I think you're going to have 12 because of the changes that you're going to make around three absences. And the other thing that we can do is be a lot more aggressive in terms of looking at the attendance and working with the executive committee to basically replace folks who don't, you know, who miss three meetings in a calendar year.
Not that we want an engaged FAC, we need an engaged FAC.
Oh, God.
Maybe we can track the absences on a list and we put that out in the minutes. Because then somebody will see it and go, oh, man, I better go to those meetings.
Well, the nice thing about three in a calendar year is the clock starts ticking in January. So if somebody misses three right off, you know, fairly early on, we can remove them, or you can remove them pretty quickly. You don't have to wait until December.
Okay. Well, let's we'll talk about that at the next executive meeting, and we'll probably have the 21 days notice, written notice on the next day, and we will approve unless there's any more discussion on the three meetings.
I just want to offer one other suggestion. We've done this in the statutes, provide for it with elected governing bodies. If the governing body puts it in place, you can allow for remote participation. Mm-hmm. And we have leveraged that, not often, but a couple of times we've had to leverage that in order for the council to be able to do business. You just have to have rules in place and they call in. So for example, I'm up in Olympia, you know, I think it's like 2 months in a row. We canceled February, so I wasn't absent, but I was in Olympia lobbying both times. I potentially could have gone off to the corner of the legislative reception.
I think that's a good point.
For 10 minutes so that you could approve minutes.
Right, yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
And then back out.
Yeah, so. If we can put in there like a, what do you call
it's
it?
It's a remote participation. Yeah. Do you have that, do you allow that?
We do. Most frequently, we'll actually do vote by mail, email.
email, and then we'll bring it back up again at the next consent agenda.
So we invite email too. You could be at the.
Well, yeah, maybe we should talk about that at the executive meeting. The email, because I think that should be on there too. You know, probably the bylaws that votes can be approved via email. And I don't actually think it is in our bylaws. The email approval. So maybe we'll look at it and bring it back.
Great. So how about this? If you guys are okay, we'll try to coalesce this into notes and we'll send it to the executive committee. Make sure that we've captured everything, and then we can share that with the rest of the group and look at changing the bylaws. In addition to that 21-day notice for the absences, we'll also be looking at changing the bylaws for the supermajority in order to maintain quorum. And then they can have a discussion on the remote voting by mail consistently, and then including absences on the minutes. Would that be okay with you guys? Good? Okay.
And anything else you think of that would help us operate more effectively the bylaws?
Karaoke! I don't know.
One of the cautionary around the remote participation is that I've seen situations where it starts out small just for sort of emergency situations, then it becomes more the norm. Mm-hmm. And it's harder, I think, to do business when, because you lose something in the translation when you're on the phone. Yeah. So I think if we can encourage that be, and I've called in remotely when I've needed to, so I'm not against it. I just think that we don't want it to become a standard.
Well, the other thing we've done in the past is to send, if you can't make it, to send somebody as, they can't vote, but send somebody, that's an excuse absence, right? That's what we've considered.
Should an excuse absence be in writing, like if I couldn't make it? Email or writing it, rather than me just calling up Lydia and saying.
Yeah, I think a call or email, whatever works. I don't know that we want to
just
be too.
Reason.
Yeah. People are.
A note from my mother would not count, right?
I mean. It would count.
But you're such right, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think a call would be sufficient. To, you know,
yeah.
I don't think we need to type it in writing.
Or just emails writing.
Yeah, or email.
So we need to probably move on if you're okay, because we're a bit late.
So do you want me to do that? Okay. So, but we don't. We need to vote on these.
The FAC meeting dates we will need to vote on. Basically, the question is, what summer month would you want to go dark, and then
what summer month do we usually go dark? August.
It's August. Yeah.
It's been August, either right? June or August, I believe.
It's August.
Anybody have a specific month? But I mean, I don't think it matters.
Doesn't matter. No, it's just whatever people think is best.
It doesn't matter to you guys. What if you don't need anything done? I don't think anybody has any. I would say just choose the one that you think that the public health department would rather us not be part of.
Okay. And then we are proposing to meet in on December 4th to cover November and December. So instead of having a November meeting because of the holidays, combine November-December meetings on December 4th. That's what we did last year.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a Tuesday night, yep.
Okay. So we can include those on the notes too. And
so then this December 18th would actually be December 4th.
Mm-hmm. And no meeting in November.
Right. The November and the December meetings would be.
So November 20th would no longer be there. December 18th would become December 4th.
Correct.
Yep.
That makes sense.
So we're nice meeting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll work with those on everything that goes out to get voters, you know, to get to the rest of the membership, and we'll vote on that as well.
Okay.
Is that good?
Okay. That's good.
All right.
So are we voting by email or just voting at the next meeting for the dates, for the FAC meeting dates?
I think we should vote by email for the meeting dates because that's coming up. Mm-hmm. The bylaw proposed changes will have to be at the next meeting.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. And we'll also ask them to approve the minutes by mail, too. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
John, thank you for doing. You were supposed to do it last meeting, and then you did this meeting. So,
all right.
Yeah. Appreciate it. So.
No, I get to. I get to show off a little bit, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that looks like an interesting book, The Chlorine Revolution. Yes.
Yeah, actually, it's a I don't want to jump all over my presentation, but that's kind of along the lines of that Dr. John Snow.
So, yeah. Germ theory, yeah.
So yes, I get to talk with you folks a little bit tonight about public water systems. I can't remember exactly who I spoke with, but we had talked a little bit about public water systems, what they do, and kind of how they intersect with public health and some of those things. So I've been working on a high-level presentation, and I kind of wanted to share that with everyone and go over some of those things. So I appreciate everybody letting me try this out on you. It is kind of a high-level thing. I'll try to go through it fairly quickly. It should only take me, I don't know, hour and 15 minutes, maybe. So I think everyone knows who I am. My name is John Roth, and I work for Clark Public Utilities. Some of the credentials I have, I guess, as far as public water systems and why I guess I'm informed to speak about it is I do have a few licenses with the state. I do operate the Clark Public Utilities water systems. There's about 20 of them that we have, varying sizes, anywhere from 3 connections up to 33,000. And prior to that, I worked at the city of Waukegal and did the same type of work, just on a little bit smaller scale. I wanted to talk about water systems in particular, community water systems. Again, there's a lot of public water systems. The definition by the state is basically anything over 1 is a public water system. And so it can be wide-ranging, but for purposes of this presentation, I want to talk about community water systems, which are 25 residents full-time at 60 days or more a year, or 15 residential connections. And community water systems, kind of as the name suggests, are, you know, systems that would have all sorts of services. It'd be businesses, community, governmental services, a lot of different other amenities. These community water systems were sort of born out of the Safe Drinking Water Act, which occurred in 1974, but there were a lot of public water systems prior to that. What the act did do was kind of standardize all of that across the nation, so it was pretty helpful in that regard. So to talk about what public water systems are, and I touched on this a little bit already, and what the significance is, there's a definition up there of how the state kind of determines it. So the state of Washington is what they call the primacy agency, and I think everyone probably gets what that is. They enforce the laws and the regulations under the Safe Drinking Water Act, and EPA administers that Safe Drinking Water Act. These particular public water systems that I'm going to talk about are what I call the Big Six, and these are the Big Six water systems in Clark County. And I got these statistics off of the 2015 data on the internet. The city of LaCenter is kind of rolled up into this as they're a Clark Public Utilities customer. There's some other townships, Amboy and Yackel, that aren't necessarily in this slide, but just looking at what's going on here, you know, there's 460, according to those 2015 numbers, there's 460,000 Clark County residents. 373 of those are served by these large public water systems, so 80% of the population is served by these public water systems. This kind of circles back to what Chuck had sort of presented. This map is the water service areas for those water systems. Washougal's almost kind of the same color down there. At least it looks that way to me. I don't see colors real great, but in that lower right-hand corner, Washougal. Camas is the green color. Vancouver, of course, is the tan, and then you've got Ridgefield and Battleground in there as well. And then the rest of the blue area is that Clark Public Utilities. Clark Public Utilities exists in the largely unincorporated areas. We do some work in Hazeldale, but we're largely unincorporated. And we are what is called the Satellite Management Agency for Clark County, so we operate multiple water systems. We were kind of designated that by the Board of County Commissioners, the Satellite Management Agency. These water service areas
were established through a collaborative process. What it is representatives from each of these jurisdictions, along with Clark County Public Health, Clark County Public Works, the fire departments, and Department of Health and Department of Ecology. These boundaries are sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, kind of negotiated and established where folks are going to kind of do business, and there's the ability to grow into some of these service areas. So these service areas will be larger than, you know, the incorporated areas. Some quick statistics. This is kind of on water pumping. These numbers, you can get them right off the state databases, but in 2016, we pumped in Clark County, those big six water providers, about 16 billion gallons of water in a year. That's enough water to provide every resident in the county with 93 gallons of water every day for the whole year. Or, to put it on another way, enough water to give every person on the planet 2 gallons for a day. That sounds like a lot of water, but and it is a lot of water. But when you start talking about some different things like fire suppression, manufacturing, jobs, irrigation, watering grass, for instance, if you have a small patch of grass, 10 feet by 20 feet, about the size of a parking spot, and you put an inch of water on that, that's 125 gallons of water that goes out on that. Some other little interesting tidbits, these plastic water bottles, the manufacturing of like bottled water, 5 to 11 times the amount of water that bottle holds is used to process and package and put together that water bottle. It's kind of an interesting little fact. So it's pretty neat. An acre of corn can give off 4,000 gallons of water in evaporation every day. So I wrote down some of those kind of neat little things about it. So again, it sounds like a lot of water, but it takes a lot of water to do business. And even those water systems, we typically use on order maybe 10% of our water to do things like flush out the lines and clean out, you know, sediment, things like that. New construction, you know, you don't just put new lines in service. They have to be cleaned out and disinfected, and that's part of that. Cleaning out storage tanks, sampling, there's a cost of doing business. So we use a lot of water to make a lot of water. Regulatory oversight, that is a big component of public water systems. I get asked the question a lot, what's the difference between my private well and a public water system? And there are a lot of really cool conveniences with a public water system, like we bring it right to your house, you don't have to worry about pumps. It's there, it's pretty reliable. But the biggest difference is some rudimentary treatment. I say that we disinfect and do quite a bit of sampling, but the big difference is, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 a year in sampling for that water source. Also, water systems, public water systems are approved. That's another oversight or quality control process. So the Washington State Department of Health adopts standards. There's things like NSF ratings, which are National Sanitation Foundation ratings, American Water Works or AWWA standards, a lot of things that are vetted and reviewed over a long period of time, years before they're adopted. But these standards are in place, and there are engineers that are looking at those standards and these water systems to make sure that they comply with that. You can't just run out and throw ABS pipe in the ground and start delivering water to people. There's a lot of approval processes and oversight that go into these water systems before they can be delivering water to the public at large. A good way for us to kind of check in on how we do with our flushing, whether that statistic I gave you on the 16 billion gallons of water, I mean, that came directly off of a collection of those reports.
water quality check, so we sample sources every year for certain things like nitrates and different inorganics like lead and copper, and those things are all included in some of these reports. Anyone that's on a public water system, I'm guessing it's probably a lot of folks in here, you get a every year you get a report from the water company, and it has a table in there and tells you what they sampled for and what the levels that they detected were in there. They'll give you some information about where their water system, where their sources are at, what kind of water it is. Groundwater, Chuck talked about that. In Clark County, we're almost entirely groundwater. Camas has a surface water source, but they've got some pipeline they're working on, so it's not really in service, and it's only seasonal when they do use it. So these types of reports and those types of reports that you get in the mail can be really informative and tell you a lot about water quality. The other thing is those are all public information. So with a water system name or a number, or you can even call your water company if you had a question about, if you were moving someplace, you can call and ask and drill in and find a lot of these details on some of these, the things that are in the water and some of the challenges they may be facing. Waterworks operators are another big component of public water systems. I like to joke I'm a little bit of a closet engineer. I hold engineers in high regard. I mean, they're super smart people, but waterworks operators are kind of born. They were an engineer solution to operating water systems in the 70s, in the 60s and the 70s. There was a lot of money being appropriated by the federal government to build wastewater plants and to build water treatment plants and, you know, a lot of these public infrastructure projects, and they weren't necessarily producing the types of results that the engineers and sanitarians said that they would be. And the legislature kind of called them on and asked them about it. And they said, well, look, these things don't just run themselves. I mean, they are pretty cool, but you need talented and knowledgeable operators to run those because they have to read the inputs and the outputs. I'd like to flash this quote up here. It's something I read early in my career. I don't know exactly who's credited with saying it, but I've used it a lot. When I left the city of Washougal after 14 years, I got a plaque, and on the plaque was this water meter, and on the register, my crew had rolled that thing back or rolled it forward to the number of days that I'd worked at the utility, which I thought was pretty cool, and this quote was engraved on it. It was probably one of the most thoughtful things I've ever gotten. It's kind of a neat memento. The basics of water system operation, this is kind of the nuts and bolts. This is essentially what all water systems, you know, at the most basic level do. It is a little bit of an oversimplification. Disinfect water supply, I mean, could mean treat. There are sometimes you do a little bit of filtration. Groundwater will have things in it, minerals in particular. In your communities, you may hear people complain about white spots on dishes and stuff like that, and that's pretty common with groundwater systems, but in the battleground in North Clark County area, there's a lot of iron and manganese in the water, and it can impart a taste, or you could get staining on fixtures and different things like that, so we will filter some of that out. So we disinfect the water supply. We don't want to run out of water, maintain pressure, and do a lot of sampling and testing. Those are the basics. Disinfection, and that's kind of a reference back to this book, this Chlorine Revolution. It was like my second or third FAC meeting I was here, and I remember Dr. Melnick talking about Dr. John Snow and the Broad Street pump in London in the 1850s where, you know, people were getting sick, and back in those days, they thought that a lot of these diseases and things just kind of emanated out of the ground or trash piles. People just threw human waste out in the street, and it piled up, and it was an absolute mess, and they never really thought about their water supply. He was sort of a pioneer and discovered that linkage between, you know, waste and human activity and the contamination of the water supply. He famously took the handle off that Broad Street pump. And if you advance, and that story was interesting because I read it in this book, which is the story I'm more familiar with. You advance forward 50 years from that, and in the early 1900s, and a gentleman by the name of Dr. John Leal and George Warren Fuller, which is probably the smartest engineer ever to walk the planet, built the first chlorinated system in Jersey City, New Jersey. It was a 1 million gallon per day system that used chloride of lime to disinfect the water supply. And after they built it, they were promptly sued by the federal government. But here we are, you know, 110 years later, and people live almost twice as long as they did then. I mean, the average life expectancy was, like, you know, 50s or something like that. And there was an urban penalty for living in urban areas, which basically meant that when you lived in an urban area, you weren't going to live as long as in the rural areas. And we, you know, that's been completely eliminated. You know, the chlorination and disinfection of water, wastewater streams, is a pretty remarkable advancement, I think, in our civilization. So that's one of the pillars that we're talking about of the basics. It's kind of a neat deal. The other one, of course, is water production and delivery. Of course, our customers expect not just water in abundance, but they want it at every fixture in their house, and it's got to be pristine and those things. And I don't know if I kind of watch the water news, but they're talking about Cape Town, South Africa, running out of water this year. Like they call it, they actually have a name for it. They call it Day Zero, where they're going to run out of water. And essentially, they're just going to shut everything off, and they're going to start rationing water. I mean, I can't even imagine that. Imagine standing in line for your ration of water. But the reality is that in a lot of places, people walk miles every day to get their water. And we are very fortunate here to have it piped into our homes, and not just into our homes, but into every room in our home and some of those things. We complain about water spots on our granite countertops, and you know, our water bill's too high because it costs almost as much as my phone bill. You know, it's kind of nuts. Another big one is maintain pressure. If the biggest complaint is water quality around taste and odors, you know, it smells like chlorine or it tastes funny, the second biggest complaint is maintaining water pressure. These systems are difficult. A quick little fact about, and again, I'm most familiar with Clark Public Utilities, but we serve elevations from 50 feet above or 40 feet above sea level up to 1,440 feet above sea level. And if we were going to provide 50 pounds of pressure at 1,440 feet above sea level, that would be like 680 psi down here at 50 feet sea level. So there's this wide range, you know, and you have to break that. So maintaining the pressure can be difficult in some of these areas as you move up this grade, you see. And so we don't necessarily, we're trying to maintain a consistent or reliable pressure so that people can deal with it, those different things. Pressure is important for several other factors. It moves water from A to B, from place to place. We pump a lot of water in the lowlands area of Vancouver Lake and push it out into Battleground in the foothills of the Cascades, and that keeps it out there, and it also helps keep contaminants out of the water system. If you can imagine it, just the volume of pipelines and all that stuff out there, leaks are inevitable, and if water can get out, then stuff can get in, and pressure keeps stuff kind of pushed out so that you can maintain the quality of water. The last or the final little pillar here is the sample, test, and observe, and we do that quite a bit. We'll do that at the source, we do that in the distribution system, we do that with the end user. We're checking those things out. Operators, I know a few, and they can, some of the best operators are a little obsessive, compulsive. You know, they're looking for anomalies. Boring and plain is the order of the day. It's more about perfection than it is quantity or some of those other things. They're just looking for anything that's different. And water actually has a pretty good reputation. If you think about it, everybody expects their water to be safe. And for the most part, they think that we do a pretty good job. And so we don't take that trust lightly. We're out there every day trying to make sure that we can maintain and keep that kind of going. I went through that pretty quick, but that is just about it. I've got if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or my contact info is up there, and I'm happy to speak with anybody on the phone or exchange emails.
Do you have opportunities for people to go out and kind of see firsthand how this all works? I had an opportunity to go out, and it was really fascinating. So do you, when you, is that a possibility with RPUD?
We do. We do have opportunities to do that. We have facilities that we've toured. Drinking Water Week is typically the first week of May. I know at Washougal we've even done stuff there in the past. We've done some, you know, some of the bigger facilities. But I would recommend, you know, first maybe reaching out to those jurisdictions in particular. But okay. Clark Public Utilities would be no problem. You can get a hold of me and we could probably set something up. But I would encourage you to reach out to those. And typically there's some type of program that can accommodate that. We love to talk about our water, so.
Yeah. For the quality of water, I'm sure there's federal guidelines, state guidelines, right, in terms of what can be in the water, how much there can be. So is like Washington state guidelines more stringent than federal guidelines, or is it different from city to city, like Battle Room is different from Vancouver?
There are what they call national primary drinking water regulations, and they're set by EPA, and they're the same across the nation. Those what they call primary drinking water regulations. When you get your report from your water utility, your annual report in the table, it'll have a column and it'll say MCL, and what that represents is maximum contaminant level, and that's the level, the primary contaminant level that all water systems meet. There are places in California that, you know, maybe they test for chromium 6. That's another program that EPA does administer. They call it unregulated contaminant monitoring. Mm-hmm. And large water systems like Vancouver and Clark PUD, and I know Washougal participates in the program, but every 4 or 5 years, you know, EPA says, we want you to test for this stuff, and it's not regulatory, it's not enforcement, but they use it to base future regulations on. So they're looking at health effects. They're always looking at health effects, but the standards are the same. They're standard across the nation. What you will see differences from jurisdiction to jurisdiction are those sampling sites. They might sample in more locations. They might sample, you know, different areas. Each source has to be monitored, but you know, without in the system, you know, you can test once every mile, or you can test 5 times every mile, and jurisdictions have some latitude on that. Again, there's minimums, but there's almost no water system that does the minimum.
So you may have read that some schools tested high for lead, but mm-hmm. that wasn't the source, and you may want to talk about that, but that has a lot to do with the piping in the schools or the fixtures. So I don't, but they use the same kind of, you know, may test for some of the same things already, like those lead levels are high by EPA standards.
Yeah. So that is kind of, the state of Washington has a directive on lead. The governor issued a directive, and they want the EPA guidance, and again, it's not regulation, but it's 20 parts per million or 20 parts per billion of lead at each fixture. If it's over that, they recommend taking the lead or taking that fixture out. There is a standard for water systems. It's what they call an action level. It's not like a maximum contaminant level because it's a little difficult. So we sample in homes, at people's homes. The source for contamination for lead and copper is primarily household piping and plumbing. If you imagine brass fixtures, they have lead in them. Lead solder and copper pipes. Copper has, well, obviously copper in it, but so the longer water stays, it's been called the earth solvent, right? So the longer it stays in contact with that stuff, it can dissolve or you'll have more soluble lead and copper in those systems. And if you can imagine schools, they sit over the weekend or they sit, you know, all summer and with nobody using the water, and it kind of can corrode those pipes, and that those minerals can get in those pipes. So we use action levels, and we kind of, because there's some sampling error involved. When you ask a homeowner to take a sample, I mean, I could ask 12 homeowners to take a sample, and they're going to do it a little differently, each one. It's supposed to sit between 6 and 12 hours, and we're supposed to fill it up first draw. And it's a 1 liter sample, and gosh, nobody wants to fill that thing all the way up. A liter's a lot, you know, but you have to, that's what the sample set's based on. So, yeah, it's, those types of things are, it's a little more squishy around it, but we're looking at 15 parts per billion in the 90th percentile, and that's at residence. At people's homes when we're testing for lead and copper, but schools don't fall into that because they're not normal, or they're hard to gauge because they're going to be different, you know, just because of how long the water may be sitting in those pipes. But schools have taken a very proactive step. I know all in Clark County, I worked with Joe and Chuck, and they were pushing a lot of this information out to schools about where they could go to get testing and some of those different
things. I think the lead in fixtures last was like, if they're newer than 85, is that, do you recall, or
well, the
newer fixtures shouldn't have
lead solder. The lead solder ban was 1986 the lead solder, but in 2012 they went with lead-free brass, so it's low lead brass. I could bore you with the details, but it's basically less than 0.25% is calculated across the wetted surface of, you know, lead in the brass. So that's a recent development. Lead-free fixtures, when you go to Home Depot or whatever, they'll be stamped. There's like special stamps, just like everything has a stamp on it, but it'll be a no-lead type fixture. You know, EPA and the state says that for regulatory reasons, you shouldn't flush your fixtures, but I'll tell you, if you run the water, it'll, and you freshen it up, the lead concentration is going to, lead or copper, if any's in there, is going to go down. I tell all my friends, if they're worried about it yet, you just run the fixture till the water's cold.
Yeah, years ago, I was a health officer in Washington County. We had a kid with elevated lead levels. I think her level was over 10. And found out that the parents were making formula first thing in the morning and did not run the water ahead of time. We had them stop doing it and start running the water, and lead levels came right down. Yeah.
Those mineral levels will be higher in hot water tanks, so don't use hot water. Yeah. Use just cold water and let it run. I mean, I know I'm not supposed to say that, but that's a thing. That's for real. That'll work.
Do new tankless water heaters, does that change at all?
It does, in that it's not in contact as much. It is still going to be higher out of hot water tanks. But the way those things work, right at the surface of the element in the water, it superheats that. So that stuff it's like little micro explosions that occur right on the surface, and it can blow off some of that stuff. So you'll get insoluble copper, insoluble lead, but the tankless are not, there's not as much as the hot water tanks. I don't mean to be too technical, but the tankless are better.
Interesting story about Camas in the water. I don't know if it was in the 70s or so. Part of the city was getting water from the wells, and part of it was from Jones Creek. And they had a whole bunch of Giardia cases. Uh-huh. And a local doctor was getting a lot of his patients, and he was mapping them. And then the picture came really clear. Part of the city that was on the surface water,
yeah.
Was it? And so it went from there.
That actually made national news, because up until that point, they didn't realize that beavers could transmit that, and that's what it was a beaver in the watershed.
Crypto is a problem too.
And I think they have a sand filter system now on Jones Creek.
They have a slow sand filter, and they are trying to commission. They're having some problems with the pipeline just because it's old and it's leaking. But they had a package filter plant, and I know the guy that ran it, and he originally started in the wastewater plant. The public works director at the time said, well, gosh, you can run a wastewater plant, you can run a water plant. So I moved him up there. But they're a little different. Essentially, it's got a big spray bar that rotates around it, and it stopped, and the water just augered a hole, and it was just short-circuiting through the filter. And so it wasn't getting the treatment it necessarily needed to have. He tells a fascinating story, that original operator, and he's still around. He works for Wetrick, but they learned a lot there in Camas.
So most of the source that we see is groundwater, not surface water. And that's like, so like in Portland, they have Bull Run, which is a totally different water source.
That's surface water.
Oh, that's surface water?
Yeah.
Surface water.
And so groundwater is there like a well? Or like, what are we, how do we get it out?
There are. There's wells.
Big wells.
Lots of straws. Big giant mouths.
That's a pretty apt description, actually. So there are wells all over the county. Camas and Washougal have a lot down along the area near the Columbia River and the Washougal River.
Okay.
There's some wells in that area. Vancouver, similar, you know, they're back a ways from the Columbia River, but they have wells.
And they're all maintained by their own jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Portland uses wells too, so they have wells in East County. So when Bull Run is not at full, you know, getting lower, they'll start getting into there. And it's the same aquifer; it's the Troutdale aquifer.
Yes, they're shallower, and then there's deeper.
Yeah,
internal systems that are in those deeper wells. I mean, City of Vancouver can see it when Portland turns their wells on; they can see the water levels drop.
Really?
So yeah, there's some of that.
And you remember we were involved in an issue with the casino with their injection system. They're above the Troutdale aquifer.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yes.
I've got 6 water outlets in my house.
You're the problem right there.
Yeah.
Portland can tell when you turn your water on. Yeah.
That's a big problem. Because 2 of them, and I was just sitting here while you were talking, thinking, 2 of them, I've been there for 4 years now. 2 of them I've never even used yet.
That's all right.
I mean, do I have to let it run for a long time after I...
If you're gonna drink the water out of there, I would.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to drink it, but I mean, it's... It wouldn't hurt you to wash your hands in it or anything like that.
Right. But I just happen to think, I've never used those tools.
I wouldn't drink water out of them without running a bunch of water through it.
Okay.
Personally.
Yeah. I wanted to, just a little sideline from what we're talking about, but it has to do with Park Public Utilities. I've always commended them every time they answer the phone. There is no time, 24 hours a day, you can call Clark Public Utilities and you get a person.
That's true.
You don't get
John,
a recording.
This guy never sleeps.
You don't get a recording that says, we are closed now, please call back at 8 o'clock or something like that. I always, because I'm a 24 hour person, so I, will call sometimes at 3:30 in the morning. And
just for the hell of it?
I get somebody. Yeah, and I get somebody. I get lonely.
Call your water for them.
I call them Clark Public Utilities. What you doing?
You guys are winning J.D. Power awards all the time. It's quite an organization.
Yeah.
It's quite a culture.
Yeah.
So I've got business cards. If anybody has any more questions, I would be happy to talk with you on the phone or email or anything like that. Or we could talk after if you like, but I don't want to tie everybody up.
Thank you. That was really interesting. And thanks for all you do. Guy represented.
I appreciate the chance to share.
I know you leave Washougal, but
I know.
It was all good.
Well, this is a major reason, in the 19th century, in early 20th century, why life expectancy increased. Yeah.
Well, this is public health. I mean, I feel like water systems is like it's the beginning of public health.
Talk about chlorine. The director of environmental health years ago, Tom Barton, went over to Sudan or during the famine and everything, and he had like 7,500 people a day dying in a camp, and he just set up a plastic swimming pool and dumped chlorine at it, and he knew a little bit about monitoring and all that, but it wasn't anything fancy, and he just dropped the death rate to 1 or 2 a day, just the chlorine in the water.
Cholera is still a big problem in many parts of the world. And was it Yemen that's having? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly where, but.
Look at when what's happening in Puerto Rico and in Haiti, and all the the hurricanes and all the devastation they've had, and so some of them are still having problems with it now. Yeah, so.
We are very fortunate.
Yeah.
Although, you know, given the relationship between groundwater and surface water, and down the road as the snowpack decreases, it's going to impact what you're doing, right? Or
That is a challenge, and always looking at different things. That's why, you know, the casino thing is kind of scary, and I say scary, but there's some. It'd be nice if you could see what was going on, the oversight piece. I'm sure it's great, but those types of technologies, that's in front of the legislature now, you know, using reclaimed water for, you know, different purposes. I mean, they treat that water to a fairly high level. I wouldn't want to drink it, but I wouldn't mind washing my car with it.
It actually meets EPA standards, but the EPA standards don't cover everything. So, but there, yeah, it supposedly meets EPA standards before they put it in the ground.
Yeah,
drinking water standards, yeah.
Yeah, just put it in the ground, pump it back out again. Yeah, that's what they did in Orange County, because people couldn't, you could, you know, the guys, they have one in Orange County where they can bring all the sewer to, the guy will turn the tap on and drink it, right, because it's just coming out of their water. And people go, no, we can't do that, so they just pump it into the ground and pump it back out again. They go, oh, that's great. That's well water, that's okay.
Well, here, you know, at the casino, there is a Verdos. I mean, it's going through hundreds of feet, over 100 feet of, so, I mean, it is being further filtered as it, and we're working with them on getting some data from their monitoring system.
Each spring through summer, the Water Environment Federation, Clean Water Services over in Beaverton, they sponsor that that whole beer where they make beer out of effluent coming out of wastewater plants. And market it.
And what do they call it?
Near beer, I think.
But actually, that's why beer was developed. Beer historically was developed because of, wasn't it?
It was early water treatment, exactly. Yeah.
Beer is a water treatment.
Well, we're right at about 5 hours.
Sorry, I can go on. I love this.
I don't want to torture everybody.
I could talk about this for hours.
Paul had some things that he wanted to add. Paul, I was wondering, could we just, you and I talk off a lot offline, and then we'll add that to the executive meeting, and then we'll put it on the next agenda.
Are
you
agreeing
with that? Okay, so I'll contact you.
That'll be fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll adjourn.